Our feelings are so inconvenient to other people. It is our responsibility to be in touch with our feelings. You know, we are the person who is responsible for honoring feelings. Other people can't feel how we feel. People in tech would say like technical debt, like when you are building software and you keep just putting new code on top of code that you don't know what it means and things are getting super janky. I think that's what happens when you just try to stop and push away feelings. If someone does something that I would not do, it's like the most obvious conclusion is they are bad or they are wrong. Because I wouldn't do that. If I thought that that was good or right, I would do the same thing as them. But I don't. Sometimes people that interact with me, they're like, "Oh, you're such like a feelingsy person." Like, "Oh, this is so nicey nice." But actually, I'm an incredibly practical person. If you shame someone for how they feel, you are introducing more threat into the situation, which is going to make their emotions stronger, which is like going to spark, and then they're going to look like the crazy insane person to you. And so you have to break the cycle.
Today on Modern Relationships, I sit down with Ann Pierce, a former startup founder who became obsessed with the mission of solving interpersonal conflict. Ann unpacks why conflict isn't inherently negative, but actually builds trust when handled correctly. Up ahead, she explains that invalidation is the most common threat most of us encounter, how we misunderstand each other through projection, and how to break the cycles of conflict.
Well, Ann, thank you for coming on Modern Relationships.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So Anne, your bio is solving interpersonal conflict. For those unfamiliar with your work, why don't you give a brief background of what you're doing now and how you came to start it?
So for a long time, I was a startup founder. My most well-known company was called Photo Feeler, and I did that for a long time. And then about 3.5 years ago, I went through a divorce. And it was a horrible time. I was so shattered. And I just couldn't drop it. Like I was just in that mode of like, what could I have done? Just analyzing over and over, just in a thought loop about it. And I got really, really obsessed with interpersonal conflict. And I learned everything that I could. I read all sorts of books specifically about conflict, but then just went down a lot of rabbit holes about power, about cognition and mental health. And yeah, I just became all consumed. It was just a point in my life. I had nothing else going on. And I just had endless time to worry about this. So yeah. And I think I always was really interested in people, which, you know, even my company Photo Feeler was like I was interested in because of the social psychology angle of that. I was always really interested in like personality typologies, just figuring out people. And so it was like the combination of being so heartbroken and also just being kind of obsessed with people anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's how I got to here.
That makes sense. So on this podcast, we usually have couples or experts like yourself on, and we talk about either, you know, how to pick the right partner or how to make partnerships great. In your sort of study, when people get divorced, how much of it is it that they picked the wrong partner for them versus that they just weren't equipped with the right sort of skills to make it great, or even in your own experience?
Yeah, I think that's a really hard question. My friend Matt Fisher is really obsessed with this problem, the search problem. How do you find compatible people? How do you match people up? And so he talks about that a lot, and I was really inspired by him. So we ended up doing an unconference that was about the search problem called the Love Symposium, which was in Berkeley in November. And so we had people come from all over to talk about that, to talk about what makes compatible people? How do you match them up? It was kind of a relationship tech thing everyone had, sort of a, we're tech-minded, but how do you solve this problem? And I think there wasn't definitive conclusions reached about who is compatible for each other. I think that it's a dance between compatibility and also having these skills. you know, maybe someday we'll have the data to be able to know for sure, to be able to run probabilities. But I think right now, it's so fuzzy. It's so fuzzy. Like, because there's someone who will bring out a side of you that no one else you meet will bring out. It's like, do you want to be that side of you in your life? Do you want to be this other side of you that this other person brings out? Is it that really, like, can you rank that easily? It's like, this is better than this. It's just so, it's so fuzzy. And then because you are in relationship with this person, you change them. You change them. They change you. And so it's just this, like, incredibly complex living thing. So it's so hard to say what is compatibility.
Yeah. In your own life, or in the life of people, when you give advice, like, how do you think about it on a more micro level for yourself in terms of what compatibility means for you?
Yeah, I would say so. One of the big things that I've come to in my work about interpersonal conflict is that, so first of all, I want to define, to me, a conflict is just a disagreement. Conflict is not bad. Conflict is important. Conflict builds trust, builds intimacy. When you have a disagreement with someone, it's vulnerable to tell them that. Someone might yell at us. They might tell us that we're bad, that we're wrong in ways that are hurtful. It's very vulnerable to put yourself out there with sharing disagreement. But there's a way of doing disagreement where it does build intimacy, where it doesn't turn into a fight, where you can hear each other and you can validate each other and try to understand where each other is coming from. And then that's intimacy. So what really turns a disagreement into a fight is threat, is that we perceive threat. And just to kind of, like, tunnel into that. So what is threatening? Well, we are threatened by consequences in the world. Like, something bad is going to happen. Some harm is going to come to me or people I love. That's pretty clear and well understood. We're also threatened by things that make us bad or wrong, that threaten our goodness or belonging or identity. And that's, I think, the one that's more prevalent. That's kind of always in the back there, ready to be threatened. And so I would say, if someone is pressing those buttons for you, those buttons about your goodness and your belonging, that's something to be aware of. Someone who's maybe triggering you in those really deep places. So I don't think we can totally do away with that. I think that all human beings are susceptible, especially when we're under stress. We're just, you know, going through life with someone, so many different things will happen that there's going to be a time when my insecurity comes up and he says the wrong thing. But I do think you can avoid people who just really consistently press that button. So that's sort of how I would think about compatibility.
Do you buy this sort of, you know, thinking, either whether it's Enneagram or other types of thinking like that, or is it really just such a case-by-case basis?
I actually love the Enneagram. One of the reasons I love it, though, like, and I know it doesn't have a lot of, you know, scientific basis, kind of, but it's very old, which is really interesting that it is so old and it's kind of survived. People found truth in it. They sort of were able to use it as a shared language in order to speak something that felt true to people. Actually, one of the things I really like about the Enneagram, for people that don't know, this is a personality typology. There's 9 personality types with the Enneagram. But one of the things about it is they make a distinction between being healthy as your personality type and being unhealthy as your personality type. And I love that. I think that that's the thing. And also the Enneagram's about deep wounds, about, you know, I have this kind of wounding. This is the defense mechanism that I've used in order to get through life. And so maybe my defense mechanism, maybe I'm an Enneagram 3 and my defense mechanism is I'm going to be really amazing. I'm going to win all the awards and I'm going to get all of this external validation. And I've lived my life like propped up on all of this external validation. If I'm getting into a relationship with someone who does not give me validation, or who like pokes me, if I have like a self-esteem wound and then there's someone who pokes me in that wound, then that feels like a compatibility issue to me. Like I said, it's always going to happen. But if this is like happening a lot with this person, then that's probably a problem. But yeah, I love the Enneagram and things like that, that sort of give language to you can say, well, oh, I'm a three. Okay. So now I can derive certain assumptions from that. And we can talk like anything that gives you like scaffolding in order to quickly talk through these sorts of things. I love that.
Well, just while we're on that topic specifically, that's helpful to know. Are there other sort of top of mind wounds that come to mind that are helpful for people to have in their toolkit?
Yeah. So in the attachment world, I've read a lot on like attachment disorders, people that have just people, you know, maybe that lean anxious attached or avoidant attached, like you maybe cling to people too much or you push them away and you're scared of intimacy, whatever is going on there. I've read that one of the sort of proven treatments for that is to deal with these sort of core wounds about self. And that I don't know how to say. I was going to say most people. I don't know. I'm not going to make that assumption, but very, very common to have these scripts that, you know, somewhere along the way at a really sensitive moment, something was said to you and you internalize that as, oh, I'm bad. I'm like kind of a bad person, actually. Maybe I should hide this from people because if they knew that I'm a bad person, they probably like wouldn't hang out with me. So yeah, I'm a bad person is one. I'm defective in some way. Other people can do life easily. Things come naturally to them. They're good at stuff. Not me. I'm stupid. I'm like, I like just have trouble with things in a way people don't have. Is it like another one? Or I'm like unattractive in like a deep way. Not even my physical looks, but just something in me is deeply unattractive that if people really knew me, they would be like grossed out by me. Like there's just all the ways that you can imagine someone feeling that they don't belong or that other people would feel repelled by them. Like that's going to be a super common thing that someone is carrying around with them.
Wow.
We'll get right back to the conversation after a word from our sponsors. Modern Relationships is sponsored by Relationship Hero, your personal relationship coach. It's an open secret in Silicon Valley that people are using these relationship coaches. Over 100,000 users are happy they tried Relationship Hero. You might be wondering, what is it like to talk to a relationship coach? Well, here's Jackie Pugh, a senior coach at Relationship Hero.
That's a really good question. Okay, I actually just got off a call with a client who was getting mixed signals from his ex. So she's the one that broke up with him, but then she kept sending him these really heartfelt, long, emotional messages at midnight, and then in the morning would act like nothing ever happened.
We've all been there. How do you recommend handling something like that?
So what we would do is we would want to hear exactly what's going on so we can help discern, is my client's ex, is she just trying to process her emotions and she's doing it via text message? Is she potentially trying to keep my client on the back burner? Or is she actually trying to reconnect? And if she is, then I help my client decide, you know, is this something that he actually wants to do, reconnect? And if so, why?
Thanks, Jackie. If you want to try your first one-on-one or couples coaching session, go to relationshiphero.com/modern. You'll get $50 off your first session if you use our link. Again, that's relationshiphero.com/modern.
Let's go back to conflict. So you have this great tweet, you know, essay, which we will, Twitter essay, which we'll link to, and a couple quotes from it. Conflict is the test by which people can learn how much they matter to each other. The other one was sort of, well, one, the idea of just being threat sensitive, the term threat sensitive was introduced to me by your post. And you said the most ubiquitous threat most of us encounter day to day is invalidation. Why don't you unpack that one?
Yeah, invalidation. So someone telling us that we are bad or wrong, but it's interesting. It's like I'm saying, it's like we have these wounds and maybe we're aware of them. Maybe we've done some sort of inner work and we've realized, oh, I have a wounding about like, I think I'm bad because whatever. Or maybe we totally don't know. Like I would say it's probably more common that people just don't even realize the programming that's sort of running their system. And so you're going through life and you're talking about something innocuous. You're talking about, I don't know, book that you read, and you have a certain take on it. And then someone is like, that makes no sense. And it just hits you in this place of, oh, yeah, there's something wrong with me. There's something wrong with me that I read this book and I guess I didn't understand it or something. But again, this might be so subconscious. You might not be aware that you are being threatened in this way, that this is like threatening your identity as a person who is intelligent, as a person who is like of the world and understands things. You might, it just, for whatever reason, your heart rate is going up. You like are suddenly like, when this happens physically, it's like a self-protective thing. It's anger. It's not everyone feels the anger, but it's a self-protection mechanism. We kind of turn into a binary. Like there's something about our focus gets like, we get this like laser focus and it just, the world falls away and it is me and this other person and we are at war. So yeah, so this is the sense of being invalidated, is that we are bad or we are wrong. We're so prone to this. This happens to us all the time, probably like multiple times a day. And maybe we don't have the big reaction every time because we're not being hit in our most sensitive spot. But just it all being told that we're bad or wrong in some like distant way that has nothing to do with actually us, it's just a really primal thing. We're really sensitive to that.
And so intellectually, we can understand, hey, saying someone is bad or wrong is probably not going to be super effective to getting them to change their behavior in a way that is conducive to increased connection. Maybe you could say more about that and then more about this idea of, okay, you can understand intellectually, but how do you change that? Or what should you do instead?
Yeah, I think it's hard because someone has to break the cycle. There's two ways to think about it. You can think about it preventatively. Like, I'm going to go through my life in this way. I'm going to speak to people this way. I'm going to train myself in this way of speaking so that I trigger people less. And then they're not getting mad at me. And then we're not spiraling into fights so much. So it's probably good to like train yourself that way. But also then if you just step into it, if it's just you're speaking off the cuff with someone that maybe you're really comfortable with, and so you're not using this language to try to soften things so much, you're just saying something and they found threat in what you said and they're getting angry with you. And so they're making you bad and wrong. And you are feeling the sensations in your body of someone is making me bad or wrong. Like, one of you has to be the one to like have first notice, to first just like be aware of what is happening. Like, oh man, like they're mad, I'm mad, like things are happening, this is going in a bad direction. And then, you know, to change it, which is hard. It's like going against when you're in that like really activated state to like try to like self-regulate yourself, to try to like calm yourself down enough to like get into the meta of what's going on. The oh, that must be important to you. There's something about that didn't hit right for you. And then they can feel heard, you know, they were angry with you because they're being self-protective because something was threatened. And then when you show them, oh, I'm not going to fight you, like I'm on your side, like I care about you, then it has a way of, you know, the melting people of, oh, I don't mean to roar because this person is on my side. And
you, quoting you, fights are never about the thing they appear to be on the surface.
Oh man. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think like relationship advice kind of stuff has been saying that for a long time, but it's something that's hard to like internalize and to see in real time. There was an old book or something that was like, oh, it's not about socks on the floor or something. Like people have been saying this forever, but it's just so hard. It's like I said, there's something that happens when you're in that emotionally activated state that you develop this laser focus. You see the world in binaries. Like, it's either they can get their way or I can get my way. You lose your creativity. And that's why, like, I try to tell people, because I think sometimes people that interact with me, they're like, oh, you're such like a feelingsy person. Like, oh, this is so nicey nice. And yeah, like, of course you'd think that, you know, we should all just sing Kumbaya. But actually, I'm an incredibly practical person. And I just want to do the thing that is like efficient and like saves time.
Yeah, just fights aren't about what they appear to be on the surface. And so if you ask somebody who's sort of fighting with their partner what they're fighting about, they'll often be like, I don't even remember. Or, you know, you don't even want it. It's something stupid. But
yeah, it just hit them in a spot. And one of the most influential books I've ever read was actually a parenting book. And it's called How to Talk So Kids Will Listen, How to Listen So Kids Will Talk. And it was, I love this. I love finding like these kind of extreme examples of these concepts. Like, because even I've talked to people and they've been like, oh, but this wouldn't work. You like can't let a kid just feel how they feel. Like, all hell would break loose if you just let a kid feel how they feel. But actually, there's an amazing book about that, you know, and she says, like, it's you see the transformation when you, even this person who doesn't necessarily have like amazing problem solving skills yet, doesn't have like a lot of life experience, even then, when you just give someone the space to feel how they feel, to think what they think, suddenly they get their creativity back. Suddenly they're able to actually learn how to problem solve. And yeah, and then we have a chance of seeing what actually is the fight about, what actually is under that. Like, oh, well, okay. So, and it's not binaries anymore. Before it was, you want to go to this party and I do not. These are the binaries. We're stuck in, you can't do anything with that. One of those things can happen. We can either go to the party or we cannot go to the party. But when you have your creativity back and you see, oh, actually, the world is incredibly nuanced and complicated. There's 100 ways that we could go to the party or not go to the party. What would we do instead of the party? Would we go to the party at the very beginning? Would we go in the middle? What would we do with the party? And so when you get that, your creativity back, you can see all that. And there's so many more than two options.
In nonviolent communication, they describe it as differentiating between needs and strategies. And a strategy is just a certain way to meet the need. But if you're in touch with what the underlying need is, you can sort of realize that there are multiple strategies, or sort of be creative, as you mentioned.
Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah.
What's very common is someone, usually the man, is like, oh, but you're reacting disproportionate to the offense, and be sort of triggered by someone's overreaction. Why don't you talk about what's happening in situations like that, or what can people learn from what to do there?
Earlier, you were talking about compatibility and how it's so complicated to suss out what is compatibility, because people, like, we're constantly influencing each other. And so I might, like, who even am I? I'm this person in this situation. I'm this other person. When I get into a relationship with you, I change, you change. And so that's something I think about. Just for like ease in talking about it, I do think that there is such thing as threat sensitive people. And I think we, in like the psychology world, we have like diagnoses and labels for that, for different ways that people can be threat sensitive. But I don't know. I think a lot of it too just comes down to what is happening. Like, if you think of the relationship as like a chemical reaction, like, what chemical are you and what chemical am I, and why is that causing this? And so I think that there are some people, you would have to look at their whole history. You'd have to know, like, what kind of relationships have they had all through the past and how did that go, and to know, like, is this a threat sensitive person, or are you doing something in a relationship that you keep triggering each other in a certain way? So yeah, and I just in general, I think it's helpful to try to hold off on those kinds of judgments with people and try to like give people the benefit of the doubt in the moment.
Yeah. When you explain sort of a little bit behind the science of emotions, or how should people understand what emotions are so they can better appreciate what's happening?
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a great book I read years ago called How Emotions Are Made that talks about how emotions are a physical thing. Emotions happen in your body. It's your like internal alarm system. You perceive a threat. It's often threat. And then things happen in your body so that you are prepared to get out of that situation. So maybe your digestion slows, your heart rate goes up, your blood is moving in a different way so that you can take the necessary actions that, you know, your body thinks might need to happen. And so, yeah, your emotions are a physical thing in your body. They're involuntary. It's kind of a crazy thing. I think over time, especially like, you know, it's like way back in the day, people were very, very superstitious. And so then, and then we had like the Enlightenment, and then we came to these ideas about the scientific method, and we need to be objective. We need to find out what is true in the world through this system. And we almost fooled ourselves into thinking that we are rational, that we're capable of rationality. And I love that there is kind of a resurgence in having an honor for emotions, because I think, but I think we're still kind of in like the toddler stage of it. Like there's like people in the world who are kind of like, who are really pro emotion, but maybe in a not productive way. Like, oh, if you feel a feeling, you have to do the thing. Or you feel a feeling and therefore the other person is bad. Like that's maybe like, you know, the trying to honor emotions, but in a way that's not fully understanding emotions. And so I'm hoping that as we start to get back and to see the value of emotions, we'll be able to find this place, how I think of them, which is like, this is your inner alarm system. This is your inner truth. There are things that you can't learn from learning the world. Like, what are your values? What do you enjoy? Who are you? What is your personality? What are you like? You can't look out into the world. You can't use the scientific method like out externally to find that out. How you find that is in your feelings. Is you do something and you realize, oh, I'm really bored. Oh, I'm really angry. And, you know, and so I'm of the mind that emotions are never wrong, because I don't think that you should, I don't think people should be shamed for things that they cannot control. And I am very adamant in my belief that we cannot control our feelings. We are not in control of our feelings. Our feelings are involuntary. And so they're not something we should be shamed about when they've already happened. And in fact, if you shame someone for how they feel, you are introducing more threat into the situation, which is going to make their emotions stronger, which is like going to spark, then they're going to look like the crazy insane person to you. And so you have to break the cycle again. You have to, like, if you are the one who has like a little bit more of a handle on the situation in that moment, then it's your job to like, okay, I'm gonna validate them. I'm gonna cease in thinking that they are bad and wrong, and I'm going to withhold that judgment. I'm gonna have compassion for them and try to like show the ways that they are right. They're right. There's something going on. We don't know what it is, but there's something in there that is causing these feelings. You don't have feelings like that out of nowhere.
What if someone's listening to this saying, hey, I wanna break the cycle, I wanna improve my capacity to do that. How do I work on it so that when I'm in that sort of heated moment, I have, you know, increased capacity?
Yeah. I think there's probably emotional regulation tools would be like a good first step. Like there's a lot of stuff. Johnny Miller does stuff about, you know, breathing techniques, self-awareness, like feeling your own body, learning to spot those signals. Like, oh, I'm getting angry. There's a lot of people that aren't very in touch with their body that maybe don't notice when those things are happening. And so that would be a good first step, is to just have that. You can't change something if you don't notice it, if you aren't aware of it. And so developing like kind of a self-awareness would be a good first step, and a capacity, like noticing that. But one of the tools that has worked the best for me personally is, oh my God, there was like, this is so random. There's this woman, Emily McDowell, and she created greeting cards. She was like a cancer survivor, and she created these like very irreverent greeting cards way back when. And she like had a greeting card that was basically like, are you like having a strong feeling right now? And you're like thinking a lot about it. You are thinking your feelings. That is not the way to process this. That is not the way to resolve this. Try feeling your feelings. Try like tuning into your body. Like where do I physically feel that? Oh, I feel embarrassed, and I feel it like in my gut. Like there's just, oh, I feel it in my gut. Oh, it's like a knot. It's like a knot in my gut. And then you like put your awareness on it, and then you can kind of feel it. It's almost like it's kind of, this is like the most woo thing you will ever hear me say, but just like everything is like mirrored onto each other. Our relationship with ourself is our relationship with other people. And so when we validate ourselves, when I can like feel the embarrassment in my belly and like be like, hey, it's okay. You can feel that way, belly. Then it like softens. It's like, oh, thanks for seeing me. Okay. Yeah. All right. We're good now. Like we can go about our day. And so when you can do that with yourself, and what a greater way to just solidify that concept into your body than to first validate yourself. And then of course it makes perfect sense to do that with other people. Another way that I've started talking about this, because in the spirituality community, people are familiar with resistance or non-resistance as concepts. And so I like to also say it that way for people that's more resonant, because the emotional validation stuff sometimes feels a little touchy-feely for people, but the resistance or non-resistance, it's like I can be resistant to my feeling. I can be like, oh my God, really? You're embarrassed? Like, how, like, be a little more like, you need to like handle yourself. Like, why are you so sensitive right now? I can like do this resistance where I'm not accepting how I am. I'm fighting against it. Or I can be non-resistant. I can be like, I guess I feel embarrassed. Like, okay, you're allowed to feel embarrassed, and that's okay. And like, just things go better for ourselves, and things go better with other people when we can get into that place of not resisting, that place of acceptance.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, some overachievers will hear this and be like, oh no, I resist laziness, and that's why, you know, I'm able to wake up in the morning and, you know, do my enterprise SaaS thing or you know, whatever it is. That's, it's not like I want to wake up and go do this. I just summon the willpower and overcome. And so, yeah, I guess some people have more of like a stoic sort of disposition to that. So just what you might say to some of those people. Another question that gets at the same thing is like, because these people are sensitive to woo kind of language, but, you know, like feel the feelings, but like, maybe you can explain what's actually happening in the body such that when you press, you know, pay more attention to the feelings and try to actually go deeper, that they actually like the idea of like them moving through the body or process, like, how does that actually happen?
Maybe just thinking of like a river, like if you put a dam in a river, it can no longer flow. Just that it seems clear from experience that trying to stop an emotion does not work, that it kind of, you like people in tech would say like technical debt, like when you like are building software and you keep just like putting new code on top of code that you don't know what it means and things are getting super janky. I think that's what happens when you just try to stop and push away feelings. They're still there, still kind of like under the surface. And yeah, and so it just, there's something about letting it flow that it can reach a conclusion. This is something that a lot of people have observed.
Yeah. And another thing you write here is that we're basically misinterpreting each other all the time. And when you ask for clarification, you maybe, you know, are surprised, or you learn something that's less threatening. Why don't you explain what that looks like, or what you mean by that?
Oh, man. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. We're not, we think that we are seeing other people's points of view, and we're not. We are projecting. This is our natural mode of being, is projecting. And I've gone down a rabbit hole with like the brain and our capabilities as human beings, how many things we can remember at a single time. Just like our window is so small of our like working memory, our just we are constrained in our capacity. And so we use a lot of heuristics. You can all of the heuristics we use are crazy. We don't even see through our eyes. I just like, my brain is like creating the image of a printer rather than me actually seeing the printer that's right there. It's just a memory of me having seen it before. And it's not until I actually look directly at it that my eyes see it. Just there's so many heuristics going on just in order for us to be able to function. We understand our own experience. And largely that is subconscious. Largely we're not understanding what we're pulling from when we make judgments, but we're sort of in a pattern of thinking based on our life experience. And we're going about our day and we're seeing other people do things and we're judging them as if they are us. And so if someone does something that I would not do, it's like the most obvious conclusion is they are bad or they are wrong. Because I wouldn't do that. If I thought that that was good or right, I would do the same thing as them. But I don't. So I'm thinking they must be doing that. Why would I do that? I would only do that if I was selfish. If I was not thinking about anyone except myself, that's why I would do that. And so we make these judgments about people. This is our like natural way of being, is making judgments about other people. And so we have to go against the grain in order to train ourselves to be able to. And I think it's like almost one of those things you have to kind of like see the optical illusion a couple times. And then once you do, you're freed. You don't have to understand their entire life in order to give them benefit of the doubt. You just have to understand that you don't know everything.
Yeah, it's interesting. Another reason why people judge, partly for the reason you mentioned, I think another reason is to kind of set norms and say, hey, this like can't happen again or something. Like I don't want this to be a precedent or something. And so a way of saying it's bad or wrong is to say like, no mas, or you don't want it to be like the norm here.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. I mean that's a threat, right? Is like, this person is doing something that is breaking my world. I don't want to live in that world. I don't want to live in the world where people RSVP and then don't show. And so this is a threat to me. I hate that. Like, so I want to be like, you know, you're bad, you're wrong. That's a jerk thing to do. But there's a way of being open to other points of view, being open to, you know, there's 100 things there that I don't even know what the correct words are right now, but like I'm often surprised when you actually ask those clarifying questions. I'm often very surprised. And I think that I know people. Like I spent so much time in like the personality typology, trying to understand people. I think I'm like an expert on people. And then I just ask a person a clarifying question and my mind is blown. I never would have thought they didn't come to the party because a particular person might be there or any number of things. Like it just hit a particular button for them or they have a totally different idea. Like in their friend group, there are different rules for how this works. And so they didn't even know this was a big deal to me. They didn't know I put a lot of effort into this. And so there's a way of holding your own boundaries where you don't have to make them bad and wrong, where it's just like, hey, like you didn't show and, you know, I put a lot of effort into this and it's really important to me to get the count. And so going forward, like we gotta only RSVP yes if we're going to come. That's like how this is going to work now. And that's like, I am setting a standard without being like, triggering them into that like deep stuff of like, you do not deserve to exist.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You put it nicely here when you say perspective taking is computationally expensive for our brain. So what we do instead is called projecting. And then Lady said, because our projecting brains give us the illusion that we understand each others more than we do, we misunderstand each other constantly, like just about always. And so the challenge is how to get back to, you know, multiple, a sort of pluralism of perspective taking, and instead of projecting or believing that our projections are accurate.
Absolutely. It's also a language thing. We define words differently. And, you know, I was saying about like, oh, am I going to go to the thing or not go to the thing? Well, if I go to the thing, I need an umbrella and all of the different possibilities there that are too hard to hold. That you just, it's just healthier to just flatten it and be, I'm going to go to the thing and I'm going to take my umbrella. language is so complicated. So I actually was just, I had a conversation. This was incredibly innocuous, but I was like looking at a menu at a restaurant and I said, oh, that's a fancy salad. I'm going to get the fancy salad. And then he was like, fancy? Like, that's interesting. I think a fancy is bad because my upbringing, da 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 da. You know, fancy is not a word that I would use in like a delighted way. Whereas for me, fancy is wonderful. I love it. I'm treating myself. Fancy is like just meant, hey, I don't want to buy all those ingredients and cut them up. I would love someone else to make me this like beautiful aesthetic salad. And so you can imagine if it wasn't a totally, you know, a situation devoid of threat where we were just, you know, making small talk. But if it was, if something was at stake and I used the word fancy and they took that in a different way, like we think that we know what a word like that means, but we don't. And there are so many high stakes words, like the word marriage, the word cheating. What does cheating mean? A lot of people have different ideas. You know, we just get in these arguments. I think most arguments aren't actually a disagreement. I think if you have an actual disagreement, like you've gotten pretty far. I think most of them are misunderstandings.
Yeah, fascinating. And so asking things like, when you say this, what do you mean by it, et cetera? Or why did you do this? This is what I thought you.
Yeah, we can't hold that. We don't have the capacity mentally to just be holding all the time, like every word that is being said could have all of these different meanings. We can't do that computationally. But if we are getting activated, they're getting activated, certain words are being said, we can just see there, like, oh, because we're activated, something's happening. I'm going to check. They said this word a few times. What does this word mean?
Yeah. The other thing you say here is, ultimately, if you invalidate someone, they'll invalidate you back. If you try to control someone, they'll control you back. You win by letting go.
Yeah. It's so hard. It's so hard. Like, everyone is like, oh, if they just heard me, if they just heard me and this all gets sorted out, they just don't listen to me. We all are that person. We all, like, are feeling in these fights, are feeling like we are not heard, we are not understood. They are also feeling that. And so somebody has to be the one. It sucks. And I will say too, like, you know, relationships are a two-way street. So sometimes, well, I've heard it said, both for like a co-founder relationship or like a marriage, like a romantic relationship, that if you feel like you're giving more than the other person, that's like correct. That there is because we all, just because of our bias, we understand our own experience. So we're always going to discount their thing a little bit. So if we think that we're giving 60%, it's probably closer to even. So there's something to be said about that. But we don't always, if we are always the person that is doing this really difficult maneuver, we're always the person that, okay, I realize they're activated, I'm activated, I'm going to calm myself, I'm going to start validating them. That can be an unhealthy thing. That can be, I would just say that that's unsustainable. That can go a few different ways. That can be, I'm going to develop resentment. I'm going to just, over time, that's going to build in me. I'm going to feel that. I'm going to start to hate every word they say. Just that, like, building resentment. Or I'm going to lose myself. I'm going to, because I am the one who's constantly seeing their perspective and they are not ever seeing my perspective. I'm going to lose my sense of self. I'm going to get codependent. I'm going to get wrapped up in them and I'm going to look to them to tell me what to do in situations that I should be checking in with my own self and asking myself what I want. And that's not healthy. So I would say if it's always you, that's unsustainable. That's not good. But it's going to be you sometimes.
Yeah. Let's go back to the threat sensitive sort of idea. But on the other side, if you are threat sensitive, you want to become less threat sensitive, what can you do to help that? And maybe we can also segue, maybe that's a nice way to also segue to your post on self-esteem.
Yeah. So yeah, self-esteem is a huge issue that makes people threat sensitive, is because you're going through life. If you have low self-esteem, if you don't have self-worth, I think that's the better entry into this. If you don't have self-worth, that you have goodness, that you belong, that there are good aspects of you. Just that very basic. We're not talking about like, I think I'm the greatest ever. Just that very basic, like, hey, this is cool. I'm okay. If you don't have that, that's a really, really vulnerable way to live. And so you're going to go through life. Every interaction is going to be a check. Am I okay? Am I okay? Does that person think I'm okay? Is this thing that I'm watching on TV saying that I'm okay? And you're going to find that most things are telling you you're not okay. You know, there's beautiful people on TV. There's lots of people who think that you're wrong and bad. And there's lots and lots and lots of things you're not good at. And so if you just have this constant checker of, am I okay? Am I okay? Am I okay? You're going to find tons and tons of evidence that you're not. And so, and this is a problem. I have so many issues with couples therapy. This is one of them, which is often there's a self-esteem issue. And this is not something that you can work out together as a couple in the same room. This is like a personal side quest. That's not quite fair. It's a dance. Like there's a certain aspect that you have to realize that this is going on for you. You have to be aware of your own shame. And then you can, you know, get the things that you need to get from relationships. There's a developmental milestone by which a person develops a sense of self. And there's, you know, diagnoses for people that never develop a sense of self, like borderline personality disorder, but also people that are in really unhealthy relationships over time. Often their sense of self is corroded. There are ways just of to lose yourself. And yeah, and so you need a sense of self in order to love someone else. You need a sense of self in order to face the world. This is just an incredibly important baseline thing. And it's in large part about you and about validating yourself. Like we talked about earlier, like, oh, I'm feeling embarrassment. It's okay. It's okay, Anne. It's okay how you are. I'm not going to resist how you are. And then finding other people who can validate you so that you can know that it's not just you on your own in the world, because human beings are not meant to be alone. We are social animals. You need to also feel that you can have connection with other people. And so it's like the dance between the two.
Yeah. Yeah. People with low self-esteem, you know, the same way that maybe all stereotypes have some level of truth to them. Otherwise, they wouldn't be stereotypes. Like similarly, like, you know, sort of perceptions of self probably have some, like one is probably deficient in some way. Although feel free to push back to that. But they so over sort of emphasize that deficiency and they try to change it or hide it. But then they sort of become hyper vigilant to it. And so they look for evidence of it elsewhere and maybe even invent or exaggerate that, you know, which like leads to a spiral where they can't sort of escape that sort of self-focus. But at the same time, what you're saying is also you don't want to, you know, do the opposite of that and only focus on other stuff. So you forget they don't have a stable sense of self. But yeah, talk a little bit about what's happening there.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure I understand the question, but I will say is like, I don't know, maybe this is not a totally kosher thing to say, but people have long speculated that people with borderline personality disorder are incredibly sexy people. That these are the people who are like, you know, going to take you into the bathroom in the club, you know, because they are all about, they're trying to find something in you. And it's so, yeah, there's just an instability to that where it's there, as long as just lacking that sense of self, you're looking externally for something. And when you feel like you find a kernel of it, it's the most important thing in the world. You got to hold on to it, you know? And so in this scenario, this person who is just like incredibly fun and flirty and sexy is just like, or, you know, it's common now. We know this word love bombing, you know, people who will love bomb, who are all about you and how wonderful you are really, they're seeing something in you that they want that to be stabilized by. And then when they feel like that isn't solid, because you're a person, you're not a concept. you know, someone that hasn't gotten to know you yet, you're just a concept to them. You're not a real person. They can't really love you. And so when they find out you're really a person and you might disagree about something, then it's like their whole world is shattered. They no longer, they were holding on to you for stability, and that stability is not actually there. And so it's just incredibly tumultuous to be trying to find yourself externally in someone else.
Yeah. So one other thing you say is you think when people say you shouldn't care what people think, that's not right. When you elaborate.
Yeah, I think that's not right. It's true and not true. It's, you should be careful about which people you choose to care what they think. Like I said, if you have a wounding that you're looking out into the world, am I okay? Am I okay? Am I okay? Plenty of people are going to tell you you're not okay. And we, you know, it's meant to be our parents that are the first people that tell us, that make us feel that sense that we have value, we belong somewhere. You know, to varying degrees, we get that kind of sense of stability. We hit all of these developmental milestones from the love of our parents. But this is, we're built for those kinds of relationships. And so there's something about, being able to validate yourself. You are a person. I'm a person who is separate from other people. I have feelings that are different than other people. I'm not looking out into the world to discover who I am. I'm looking internally and feeling how I feel, noticing my own self. And that's how I discover that I am a person. And then being able to treat other people as separate people, having the capacity to love another person, and hopefully choosing people that have capacity to do the same back. And then, you know, we develop these beautiful reinforcing cycles of, I validate them. I say, hey, you know, I'll say to my friend Jessica, you know, it seems like you don't love cycling. You know, maybe you used to love cycling. Do you still love cycling, Jessica? And then, you know, she can tap into her own family. You know what? Maybe I don't love cycling anymore. And I'm like, hey, you do you. Like, you don't have to. And we have these relationships where we are not in resistance to ourselves. We're not in resistance to other people. This is connection. It's like, I'm a fully embodied whole person capable of loving another person. You are a fully embodied whole person capable of loving another person. And then we can have a real connection. We can actually love each other. I can disagree with Jessica about what I could be like the most invested person in cycling. I can be like I don't even know how cycling works, but I'll say stuff that doesn't make sense. I could be the captain of the cycling team. And I so badly want Jessica to be on my team, but I love Jessica. You know, Jessica's a person. She deserves good things. And so I'm just gonna be like, hey, yeah, if you don't feel it, Jessica, you don't feel it. And maybe she'll get access to her creativity again, and she'll be able to problem solve, like, hey, I don't actually have to quit the team. I'm just going to take a sabbatical or whatever it is. But just even in that situation where I really, really wanted her to be on the team and she's not, just this connection, this is love. This is what we were built to have. And it's just this beautiful spiral of good.
Yeah. Fascinating. You end your piece by saying it goes loving relationship, self-worth, self-esteem, back to loving relationship, and on again.
Yeah. Yeah. Someone that has cultivated that self-worth, both internally and in connection to other people, finding those people that can validate them, that can actually love them, that can actually accept them, and it, like, reinforcing, building up yourself. So I say in that article, so I see self-worth as like the kernel. Self-worth is like table stakes. Like, I have goodness in me. I have innate value. I belong on earth. I am a person. That's self-worth. And then once you have self-worth, you can develop actual self-esteem. You can actually go out and develop skills. You can take risks in life and, you know, maybe you see some success or have failures and learn from them. Be proud of those failures. It's incredibly risky to do things out in the world when you don't have self-worth, because there's no floor. There's no safety net. You could just fall and fall and fall. But when you have that sense of goodness, you can never fall farther than that. That the worst I can fail in life, I'll still belong on Earth. I'm still a person who's deserving of good things. Then you can take risks. And then doing those risks, that's self-esteem. Is like, oh, hey, I really worked at something. I really challenged myself. I showed up every day to that thing and I'm really proud. And that's self-esteem. And you just build yourself. And it's the people who have built themselves that have the most capacity to love another person.
I want to go back to something you said earlier, which is you said you have a bunch of problems with couples therapy. What are some of them?
Yeah. Well, so I don't think, you know, there's a lot of variance. I did a whole rabbit hole into like the credentialing. I said that word weird, credentialing of becoming a therapist, a couples therapist in particular. And, you know, I don't know. It largely you become a therapist through clinical hours, just doing it. Just being thrown in the deep end. Someone is, you have an advisor who is watching your work, who's kind of overseeing, but you can use any method you want. You can say, I'm Freudian. You can say, I'm going to use CBT. I'm going to use ACT. I'm going to use DBT. You can just do anything you want. And as long as you have some advisor who will sign off on that and will say, that's okay that you use that method, you can do that. And so, I think we're in a strange time. I think that we're coming back to, oh, emotions matter, mental health is important, but we haven't quite as a society reached, we don't have agreement about what that means, how to deal with emotions productively exactly. And one of the things is this our whole mental health process. So we have like therapy is the gold standard. So if someone is having a problem, whether it's one of your close friends, whether it's someone on Reddit, someone is going to say to them, you should go to therapy. This is just our go-to right now because we now value, you know, mental health. But I think therapy has all these problems. I think the therapist gets triggered. Especially like couples therapy, like I said about the brain, we're really limited in our capacity. And so you can imagine just even trying to be so self-aware of yourself. What's going on with you? Like this person is speaking to me. How am I feeling right now? Is a lot for the brain, let alone I'm going to just use all of my strength to also understand this person in front of me. When I'm feeling triggered or something is like not sitting quite right with me, I'm going to try to understand their perspective. Add another person. And that's couple therapy. So now there's three people. I don't think that this is actually functionally possible for a human being. And I think therapists are just people. Therapists, maybe, you know, there's something to be said about you study the thing that is, you know, maybe a wounding or a problem for yourself. And so maybe a lot of people get into being a therapist because they have struggled. And so if they have their own trigger, you know, maybe... Or just even in the process of doing their job, maybe they've seen a lot of men who've cheated on their wives. And so now someone comes in and they're immediately going to choose a position, even if they don't say it out loud, in their body, it's evident that they have something against this man, that they're quicker to believe this woman than they are to believe this man. And so couples therapy can be incredibly triggering. It's my experience in couples therapy, we saw a lot of couples therapists, myself and my ex-husband. Was almost of like rigging the jury. Like who is going to see my side? who is going to side with me? Which is such a nonsense way of, you know, and I think that there are incredible therapists out there. And I've even been exposed to people who are just doing just the absolute best a human could do. But I don't think that that's the average experience. I think the average experience is there's three human beings in a room that are all getting triggered.
Well, going back to the self-esteem point, what have you found is particularly helpful in terms of increasing that capacity? Like once you sort of, you know, understand what you wrote, what then? What next?
Increase one's self-esteem. Getting in touch with your feelings. You know, just going through the world. Our feelings are so inconvenient to other people. It is our responsibility to be in touch with our feelings. you know, we are the person who is responsible for honoring feelings. Other people can't feel how we feel. And so we are the keeper of that. And so I think that's the first thing, is starting to become aware of how you feel and what that means, like about your preferences, about your triggers, about what feels good, about what feels bad. And this is doing self-validation. This is doing non-resistance with yourself. And then when you have done that, you can start to try to do that with other people. You can know what that feels like, so that you can find people who will meet you in that, who will do that, who will validate you, who won't meet you always telling you you're bad and wrong, disagreeing in messy ways that trigger wounds, but who have that capacity to, like, to validate each other and really love each other. And yeah, and I think that's what makes us strong. I think there's been a huge misconception for a long time that what makes us strong is, like, being thrown into the deep end, is like harshness, someone, the drill sergeant who's yelling at us. I think that can get people to do extreme things, but I don't think that makes you, like, emotionally resilient. I think that makes you very brittle.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Gearing towards the end a bit here, what have we not covered that you think our audience that's interested in, you know, having more sort of constructive conflicts or deeper relationships might appreciate, or what else do you suspect is going to be in your eventual book that we haven't given full thrift to?
Okay. Oh, such a great question. We've covered a lot of ground. I'm so perfectionistic. I want to, like, put it in an order. But yeah, no, we've covered a lot of ground. Yeah. Like, someone, you're activated, they're activated. So, like, maybe let's define words. One of us has to be the one to validate the other. That threat is what's going on. Even when someone looks, like, big and scary, like, we make ourselves big and scary because we feel threatened.
Yeah.
And that's been one of the things with, like, the whole social media, like, I feel like we're coming out of the other end of, like, cancel culture, but that whole thing of, like, someone is big and scary on the internet. Let's, like, you know, when it's just, we're all like threatened. We're all scared. There's this, it's just true of how we are, of how we're programmed. And so it's helpful to remember that about people, that even when someone is attacking you, it's likely from a really tender, hurt place.
Yeah. And for people who, I think one thing that is less obvious here is, like, what does training look like, or what does practice look like? Because in many other fields, practice is kind of, like, scoped out, but people can, you know, your post really resonated with a lot of people, and they'll be saying, okay, I now get this. And maybe it's just like a scrimmage, you know, it's like practice is play, you know, practice is a sort of living, being in relationships and getting feet, reflecting on how you perform.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think a lot of it is examples. I think people need to see lots of examples in order for just to wrap their mind around what does emotional validation look like? What does, like, being open to different perspectives, not making people bad and wrong. They need a lot of examples to see that and to see that it works out. Because the reason that we have our natural responses are because we're trying to protect ourselves from threat. And so, yeah, I think it takes that sort of repetition, both of seeing examples and doing it, in order to realize that, oh, this is safety. I thought I was protecting myself, but I was actually creating a problem. This is what actual safety is. And so I'm really hoping to do that with my book. I'm so excited. Yeah, just to create, like, all of that, all of those examples, just to be able to, that people can internalize that, and things that people can try right away, that they can start building up that sense of, oh, I expected that this would be horrible, but actually it was, like, the deepest intimacy I've ever felt. Like, once you felt that, then it's in you, you know?
Yeah. Before we go, maybe you can give a plug around the conference that you do, the symposium, or more just share other things that people may want to pay attention to in the field or are curious about this world.
Yeah, I would love for people to go to my website, annpierce.com, and sign up for my Substack. And yeah, I organize an unconference called the Love Symposium, which is for people, for builders in relationship tech predominantly. But oh my God, it's so fun. Just exploring ideas around relationships in a modern way. Like, you know, I speak a lot about the limitations of our brain to be able to really understand another person, to really meet them. And, you know, it's amazing to speculate about what's going to be possible a short time from now with AI. And so that's kind of at the heart of the Love Symposium, which is in Berkeley. And it's going to be again November of this year. And so anyone who's interested in that, like, yeah, definitely my website, annpierce.com. Yeah, get hooked up. Yeah, it's going
to
be awesome.
Amazing. Well, just to that end, in terms of your own study in this, what have you, how do you think about what you don't yet have answers to, but want to have answers to? Or what are your biggest questions as you're sort of going through your self-study here?
Yeah, I'm always like picking at edge cases. Like, I think that I have the shape of it, where I'm just seeing it over and over. Things are playing out in very, very predictable ways. But just these like far out edge cases that often converge. Like, I think sometimes someone will seem like a total enigma to me, and then I'll like follow them long enough and I'll be like, oh no, all along it was just this. I just couldn't see it because I'm projecting. Our brains can't, you know, I don't know their whole life experience, so I'm misinterpreting them. But yeah, I'm just super fascinated by all that. I'm fascinated by personality disorders and neurodivergence, autism, ADHD, the different ways that maybe brains are certain, are patterned in a certain way, that maybe the strategies of untangling that, you know, need a little more force behind them or need to be done with a little bit more precision. Yeah, I'm really interested about these like kind of extremes.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, Anne, I know many other people were really moved by your writing. And so thank you so much for coming on the podcast and getting deeper into some of them with us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Modern Relationships. Please make sure you're following on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. If you have a chance, leave us a review or comment on this episode to let me know who else you'd like to hear from on this show. Modern Relationships is a podcast from Turpentine, the network behind Econ 102, Upstream, and Turpentine VC.